Hello, it is May 19th, 2014. This is episode 419 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on Sports Unearthed. Today's death, Lee Tobler, who died May 19th, 1975. Tobler was a Swiss model who was trained to become an actress when she met a struggling artist named H.R. Geiger at the age of 17. Geiger, 26 at the time, was immediately smitten by her vitality and her stated desire to have a, quote, short but intense life. The two lived in various condemned buildings together, using massive amounts of heroin and carrying on various affairs openly with other people. Their on-again and off-again relationship, which once included Geiger filming guests at one of Tobler's galleries wearing shoes made entirely of bread, consisted often of Tobler just modeling for Geiger paintings, including his famous paintings of Lee. Geiger was finally breaking through with his art when Tobler, as she had always predicted, died by shooting herself with a revolver. Geiger, who of course ultimately became most well known for his design of the creature in the Alien films, but is considered a genius among surrealists, was devastated by her suicide and credits it for the dark turn his work and his life would take in subsequent years. They had been together for 9 years, and she was 27 years old. Here in Athens, though, it's really Monday. I'm Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. We're getting our baseball podcast out of the way right now, which is for our weekly baseball podcast that we do. I really don't want to talk about baseball right now because I'm sore about that Cardinals-Lynn loss yesterday, but that is the plight of the Cardinal fan. You lose a game after winning a series, and you're cranky about it. Sorry. Anyway, we're going to talk general baseball stuff, not Cardinal stuff. You're welcome. With Ryan Fagan, who is a baseball writer for Sporting News. So let's chat. All right, first off, Ryan, thank you for joining me. Now, I have a question very quickly before we start. I know they've switched it back and forth. Is it the Sporting News again, or is it still just Sporting News?
It's the Sporting News for the app that's on the iPad and iPhone, and it's just for the website. So it's kind of that, you know, you're not wrong either way.
Okay, good. That's good. Okay, because I remember, because I was writing the column for them when they switched it to Sporting News, and I got so drained into my brain that I didn't want to get it wrong. So,
it's weird to not call it TSN still.
That's right.
What it was forever.
Right. So. Exactly. But all right. So now, thank you for coming on with me. We've got as I've said, we have to do a baseball show a week because I get real antsy if we don't. I'm a fan of your stuff, so I'm really glad to have you on. I feel like the biggest story that's been going on this week, and I feel like it's strange because it's kind of a massive story in a way that it's almost like. The La Russa going to Arizona now, you know, obviously as a Cardinals fan, we knew when he retired, you know, he retired in like the perfect time at the perfect way. The year he had his facial stuff happen, he missed some games. And then my favorite thing about that is that he already knew he was going to retire but hadn't told the players, which puts an extra level of insanity on the 2011 World Series and that comeback at the end of the year. So it's like the perfect way to go out as a manager, but he did kind of talk about how he always wanted to come back and work as an executive. The Arizona seems to me a strange team for him to do it with, but then again, I don't know. It's confusing because there already seems to be like a management team in place there.
Yeah, and it is as much as any team. I think really any organization in baseball, when you have Ken Kendrick and Derek Hall, the two upper level management guys, they're very hands on. You know, and I'm not saying that is a bad thing. It's just interesting when you have two very hands on guys. And then you're adding another level of upper management, who they say Tony La Russa is going to have, final say over all baseball matters. He is the guy there. And throwing that above a guy in Kevin Towers, who's a very veteran general manager, this is not like, you know, this is a guy, it's his first go-around, he needs somebody to hold his hand. Kevin Towers knows what he's doing, for better or for worse. He makes decisions very, very confidently. So it's interesting to see, but you know, you look at La Russa, I mean, you know how competitive he was, and one of the things that he said again in his press conference on Saturday was he missed the winning and losing. He was doing good things. He was affecting change for baseball in the role that he was at as the special assistant to Bud Selig. He was involved in instant replay. He was involved in all these things that are changing a game. But he wasn't seeing the day-to-day results of his actions, I think, and being involved with a team. And that's one of the big reasons he wanted to get back in there.
Yeah, man. One of the things I loved about having La Russa as my manager, I mean, he drove you crazy, of course, as a Cardinals fan, but often, so many different ways he would drive you crazy. But the thing I loved about him is he wanted to win as badly as I wanted the team to win. I know that sounds strange, a fan would think that he would want to win more than a manager, but you feel like that sometimes. But you never felt that way with La Russa. Like you felt like it just murdered him, and that's a guy you want on your side. But it does feel strange to me because, with Towers, like Towers is not some shrieking violet, and they just gave him an extension. It's hard to see how those two could possibly coexist.
Well, that's why I'm curious to see how his role evolves with Diamondbacks. You know, Diamondbacks talk about it's been a frustrating season. They wanted to get new blood in there. Well, La Russa is not a short-term solution. They're not bringing him in to fix things in the next 3 weeks. I think trying to change what they've been doing as an organization, and that does not reflect well on Kevin Towers and the job that they perceive that he's been doing. And whether or not, you know, they like him or if they're adding an extra layer above him, another guy who has to say, okay, we like what you're trying to do with player personnel decisions, you know, that doesn't reflect well. And that's why I'm curious to see how much Tony La Russa is involved with those type of decisions, you know, when it comes to trades and, you know, is he going to have anything to say about the draft in years going forward? You know, I'm not sure. I think people look at this and they say, okay, well, is his first order of business to decide whether Kevin Towers is the right general manager or Kirk Gibson is the right manager? You know, that's the thing that people don't look at right away. I'm more curious to see how he's involved in the totality because, you know, everybody in baseball knows Tony La Russa was involved in everything as a manager, every decision down to the minutia. Is that going to be the case with the Diamondbacks? I would imagine how he's going to want to do it, but is that really going to work out?
Yeah, and well, I don't know why Towers would want to work. No, nothing against La Russa. I'm sure he has no problem with La Russa, but why he would want to, like, Towers was the GM. I guess he still is, but it feels like this position with senior baseball officer is the position. It feels like this position exists because they're trying to force Towers out. I mean, that seems to make a lot of sense, doesn't it? I mean, like if there were a rickety general manager who hadn't just got an extension and they could just fire because at the end of the year, they just make La Russa the GM, right? Like, doesn't this is this like it's not like La Russa's not gonna it's not like Theo where he's gonna be involved in like a stadium renovation or like a
Right.
remarketing of the team. Like he's gonna be a baseball guy, so it feels like if Towers didn't. It feels like to me, it looks like they're trying to force Towers out after giving this big extension. Because otherwise, I just can't see a way where the place is big enough for both of them to survive.
It's going to be interesting, and that's putting it mild because you're right. Because, you know, again, like I said, if you're a manager and you have had final say, I mean, in Kevin Towers, when he was in San Diego as the GM, he was there for what, 14 years, he decided everything. I mean, it was his team, you know, and going to the Diamondbacks, that was part of it. It was his team, and he could do these things, you know, obviously with final say from Kendrick and Hall. That's not going to be the case anymore because Tony La Russa didn't come in to this organization to sit at a conference table and occasionally say two words in a meeting. You know, he came in trying to make things different, to try to change the way it works. And, you know, it might work out that the combination of the way Tower looks at it and the way Tony La Russa looks at the game, that combination might wind up being this brilliant genius combo that we've never seen before. That's possible. It could happen. They're both good baseball minds. More realistically, it looks like it's the first step towards another general manager being there, whether it's at some point this year. You know, I mean, that's possible, or it could be down the road. It doesn't bode well for Kevin Towers' longevity with the team.
Do you think if Towers, this were the last year in Towers' contract, or they hadn't given that extension, they would have just fired him and given the job to La Russa?
Well, you know, I almost wonder if La Russa didn't want the title, you know, as general manager. I mean, I'm sure he probably would prefer the role that he has. You know, that's why if it was another situation where there was a general manager that was a younger guy or someone who hadn't done it for as long, he would come in there and provide guidance or whatnot. That would make more sense because I think the role for La Russa as it's set up, it almost seems perfect for him because he has final say. But he still has people he can delegate to a little bit. But Towers doesn't seem to be the perfect guy for that, though.
Yeah, it's a very La Russa thing to do, to get to like, okay, I'll take the job, but I want a brand new title that nobody's ever had before. That's such a, and
that's
I say
still
that out
La
of
Russa,
love.
though, isn't
Yeah,
it?
I say that out of love. That's like such a La Russa thing to do. Now you did a for Sporting News, you did a, or the Sporting News, whichever one we're talking about. You did a mock draft, and the draft is what, 2 weeks away? It's a week away. It's like a week and a half.
June 5th, yeah.
Yeah, so
June 5th.
So now it's funny. Like I'm thus, you know, to me, I have a hard time keeping with the prospects up with the prospects that have been drafted. So you know, I feel
right.
like I'm impressed that you're able to do that. But my interest level is more to look back at how you did. You know, like, you know, we're not quite to the point with Major League Baseball. Look back at how you drafted and be like, oh, someone missed next Babe Ruth at the fourth overall pick. Like, it's such kind of a crapshoot. I'm more curious about the strategy of how the draft works now. Because I've read in a lot of places, and to me, it seems like the value is just in having as many picks as possible. That seems to have as much value, if not more value, than having a high pick. Is that accurate?
Well, I think there are most teams that would rather have, like, the Royals have three picks in the top 40 selections. You'd rather have that than one pick at eight, probably. You know, I mean, if you're getting into the top one or two or three picks, and you have the opportunity in the right year to draft a transcendent player at that level, that's what you want, to get a Steven Strasburg or a Bryce Harper. But if you have the option to get more players, more opportunities, because the baseball draft is a different animal from the NFL draft or the NBA draft, and I think that's what people don't quite get. But that's also why it hasn't been as popular as, obviously, it's never going to be as popular as the NFL draft. Nothing is as popular as the NFL draft. But because these guys are coming in, and with the case of 99.9% of these guys that are drafted in the couple of days of this year's draft, we're not going to see them in the big leagues for at least 2 years, 3 years down the road. And that's why I think when you look at the strategies of these teams, you know, we can talk about organizational depth with starting pitchers, or one organization, let's say, doesn't have enough first basemen. But what it really comes down to is you're looking for the best player available. And at some point, you can try to, maybe if you're breaking a tie between the best hitter or the best pitcher, you might lean one way depending on what your organization has. But you're looking to have the best opportunity to have somebody make an impact on the major leagues 3 years down the road. And that's why the base, as much as anything, is very much a hit and miss proposition sometimes.
Now, how is it about, you know, because I know they made the change a couple of years ago, and I kind of understand it, but I kind of don't understand it. The change that they made a couple of years ago where, you know, it's having the number of draft picks, particularly having the number of high draft picks, it matters how much you can pay. Like, how does that draft scale payment stuff work now? Like, because obviously the change that it made, you can see how valuable they are now by the fact that Steven Drew and Kendry Morales still don't have jobs. I don't think that's I don't think that's just because they really want a guy in the 34th pick. There's a money, I think we've seen with Houston as well. There's a money thing involved in this, right?
There is. There's not as much of a money thing as it was in the past. In the past, the money more had to do with who a player's agent was. And if it was a Scott Boras client, you knew they were going to ask for a ton of money. And the question was, did a team want to pay that or not?
Isn't that what they tried to fix? I thought that was what they tried to fix with that, right? Because
how.
Yeah.
And now there's a limit set by Major League Baseball. A team has a collective pool of money depending on how many picks they have and where the picks are. And if you go over that, then you're severely punished. So essentially, it's a cap. It's not a hard cap, per se, but it is. And you can try to draft a guy. Like, there are a couple of guys in this year's draft. Jeff Hoffman, a right-hander from East Carolina. He was projected to be a top four or five pick, but a couple weeks ago he had to have Tommy John surgery. So maybe he gets drafted now instead of the number four or five pick overall. He gets picked at 18 or 19. And because he's going to be coming off Tommy John surgery, he doesn't have as much bargaining power as he would. So maybe a team picking him at, you know, 15, 16 can draft him, sign him for a little bit under slot, which could give them money later on to sign somebody else. So you're still working within the confines of a budget, but it's more a budget assigned by baseball as opposed to assigned by how much individual teams wanted to spend in the draft.
And there's also a fail safe now that helps out. Because in the past, I know it would be really you just lose your, like if you had picked third and you picked a guy and they didn't and he didn't sign, you just lost that pick. Like, sorry.
Right.
And now I think with this happened with the Pell, right? Like there's a like if you lose that pick, there's a compensation for you, correct?
Right, absolutely. And the Blue Jays have the only one this year. They have the number 11 pick as compensation for not signing their first rounder last year. So that's the only one this year.
Is it just first round? Is it just first round or does it do other rounds?
That, I'm not 100% sure. Okay, I believe it's just the first round, but I'm not 100% sure. Okay.
But so now, is there a transcendent talent this year? Is this a Harper Trout year or not?
It's not, but, you know, we got a little spoiled when guys like, you know, Harper and Strasburg came in back-to-back years, because that doesn't happen very often. I mean, even Mike Trout, remember Mike Trout? Yeah. He was the only guy, that's what fascinates me about Mike Trout. The 2009 draft was the first year MLB put it on the MLB Network. They invited a bunch of potential first-round picks to show up live in the studio for that draft. Mike Trout was the only one that showed up, you know, and then he slid a little ways.
Yeah, was it Randall Grichuk picked right before him?
Right, exactly. Yeah, as a Cardinal fan, I'm sure you know that very well. But lots of teams passed on Mike Trout. So to see how excited he was, I remember watching this draft and how excited he was and the fact that he was there. You're like, you know what? You can root for this kid. He seems like a good guy. And then obviously he's gone on from being Mike Trout to being Mike Trout, you know. So, I mean, it's interesting to see the way that it's developed and how the network in baseball is trying to make it a bigger deal, and I think they're doing a good job of doing that.
Yeah, that's terrific. You know, I didn't know that story. I'm surprised that that's not a bit. People don't make a bigger deal out of that. The idea that like when they invited one, he's the only one that shows, and he's so excited, and now he's Mike freaking Trout. Like that's I'm kind of embarrassed. I didn't know that about him. You're right. That makes me want to both root for him, and frankly, it makes me want to watch the draft more. like it feels like that's something they'd be selling the crap out of.
It should be. I'm always amazed that they don't do this. And there's been several times when I had to go back and think to myself, that's right. I remember watching this. You don't hear anybody. I even checked about an hour ago, just to make sure, the double and triple check to make sure I was right on that. But yeah, he was the only one. And the whole time, they kind of avoided showing him because they didn't want to, you know, focus the cameras. Like, not like the green room in the NFL with Johnny Manziel. You know, when Trout's the only guy there, they're not going to embarrass him when he came out there and kind of helped him out. But yeah, he was there. He was so excited to get picked. And it really was a cool moment.
So yeah, and I feel like I like that they're trying it. Like I know it's never going to be the same as the NFL draft. I know it's never going to be as the NBA draft. But I like that they're trying to do this. I like that they're trying to make a thing out of it. And I feel like it does, like stuff like that doesn't hurt in a lot of ways. And but is there a way to? Like, to me, unless college baseball suddenly becomes incredibly popular, or, like, it's obviously not going to be a major thing, but it's funny, one thing I saw, because, you know, the recent deal that CBS signed with minor league baseball, like, I find, on one hand, I can say, oh, people will never be into this draft, because it's so, no matter how much they do it, but people are so much more into prospects than they even were, I've always been into prospects, but they're really into prospects now, in a way that I'm not even sure they were 10 years ago. So you can see, theoretically, you might as well hang on to that option and give it a try, because someday people might, it might finally click over.
And MLB has its own network. You know, why not promote it as much as you can when you have your own channel that you can talk for 24 hours a day? But you're right, and so much of the reason that the NFL draft is a big deal and the NBA is a big deal is because it's recognizable names. You know, and while there is one segment of the population that gets excited about MLB draft, you know, it's not because they've seen the kids play, it's because they've read about them from people who have been there in the report. Thomas and Callis have been so good over the last couple of years of really trying to put news out there and information. Because most of these guys, I mean, even, you know, Carlos Rodon, most people think he's going to be in there for the 15 out of SEC. I mean, if you pulled 1,000 baseball fans, how many of them have seen him pitch one pitch for the Wolfpack? You know, you might have three people say that they have. Then you have, you know, guys like Tyler Kolek, you know, who's a 100-mile-an-hour throwing prep right-hander from Texas. You know, I mean, there's just no exposure to get these people in front of cameras before the draft, and that's why, you know, even if it was a situation where players drafted into the MLB draft were in the majors the next year, there's still not the vehicle out there necessarily right now to get them the pre-draft exposure that would be necessary to make the MLB a bigger deal on a national scale.
Yeah, but you're right about the MLB Network thing. Nothing against the idea of Chris Russo yelling in my face for another hour. I think I would be okay with I'm staying out of that one. But yeah, he does seem to be yelling in my face when I'm trying to watch baseball. All right, so the last thing I want to talk to you about, you had I think you, like me, are a sucker for independent league baseball. Joe DeLessio and I, writes for Sports and Earth and is an old colleague of mine in New York Magazine. We did a thing a few years ago. We went to every minor league baseball stadium within a 35 mile radius of New York City. So we got to see the New York Bears. We got to see the Long Island Ducks. You know, we got to see like a lot of these really. I think we saw Sidney Ponson pitch for the Long Island Ducks, which was really great because he was also awesome. He had like a no hitter through five, and he weighed like 420 pounds. Like once Ponson was out of major league conditioning program, he just was like, I'm going for it, and it was awesome, you know. And it was fun to watch. And I just love, like, I never got to see Ricky Henderson play for the New York Bears, but like, or when Canseco was doing his thing. But I love independent league baseball, and I love because it's not just those big name guys that come and play. Like occasionally you're like. You know, there was a few years ago where I went and like Stubby, it wasn't Stubby Clapp, it was Bo Hart. Like Bo Hart from the Cardinals was still like hanging around, and like, you know, I love independent league baseball, and we have perhaps the greatest possible independent league draw because Julio Franco is coming back.
Yeah, it's fantastic. When I first saw that news that he was going to sign with the United League Fort Worth Cats, I was very excited because, I mean, Julio Franco, you know, he's 55 years old. Yeah. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if he hits 300 in his little stint with the Fort Worth Cats. He's only going to be there for the opening homestand, which, and to show you what independent league baseball is, and this is not a knock on it at all, but Fort Worth Cats essentially sealed the deal and they were going to bring him in. They went to the United League and said, hey, is there any way we can get more home games at the start? Because Julio didn't want to travel. It was set up to be a 7-game homestand, and the United League gave him 2 more games. So now it's a 9-game homestand because it's better for the league if he's around for longer. It's better for the sponsors, you know, and that's fantastic. And, you know, Mike, ironically, the Fort Worth manager is Mike Marshall, who was the right fielder for the 88 Dodgers, had an 11-year major league career. And I asked him on the phone, I said, Mike, what are you going to do if he's hitting 350 at the end of that homestand? And he said, I'm going to convince him that he's got to stay longer, which cracks me up because, I mean, he might be able to. When he's playing in the Mexican League and as a 49-year-old, he hit 250. So if he's essentially a AAA competition, you know, maybe he can hit 300 against independent league pitching. It might happen. And, you know, if anyone can do it at his age, it's him.
You know, one thing I'm always fascinated by in those independent leagues are not so much the players, because I get the players. Like, listen, you don't want to let go. You want to hang on as long as you can, make a little cash while you can still do it, and you miss the game. I absolutely understand that. If I were a major league player, I would play in the independent leagues until I was 70. Like, as long as they let me play, I absolutely understand that. I sometimes don't understand the managers because you get a lot of guys like, I remember Gary Carter, the late Gary Carter used to manage, I think he managed the Long Island Ducks for a while or another team like that. And you get a lot, I think you get a lot of former players that are managing. And on one hand, I love it and I love the independent leagues. The other thing, it makes me kind of sad sometimes are they just looking for shots? Like, how often do the minor league teams like monitor these independent leagues? I never quite understand how that works.
Well, I think sometimes they're lifers and they're going to do baseball as long as they can. Sometimes they're looking to get back. Sometimes they've been out of the game and they just want to get back into the daily baseball. They want to be in the clubhouse. Now, when I first undergrad, and one of my first jobs was covering the the independent league, River City Rascals of the Frontier League. And there, the first year, the manager was Jack Clark, the former Cardinal slugger. But a couple years after that, they brought in Mark Hill, who was a former catcher for the White Sox and a couple other teams in the majors. And he just wanted to run baseball again. And he got through most of the season. And towards the last few weeks of the year, the team was out of contention. And there were all sorts of issues with the state and the city and all these things going on. And he pulled me aside one time. He's like, just so you know, this standard game or whatever. He's like, I'm going to finish off the season. He was done with it. You know, I mean, I think the frustrations that are inherent there, sometimes you just think that it's not enough. So sometimes that's why I think in minor leagues or in independent league managers, you see a lot of turnover year to year, because if they're there a year or two and don't get the shot, then that's all they want to do. Sometimes independent league managers, you know, coach two co-teams. Yeah. Division one or lower level college teams during the school year, and they do independent during the summer on the games. It is an interesting lot of independent league managers, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I think it's fun too. Like, what was the team? Was that an independent league team that Clemens pitched for a couple years ago?
Yeah, because his kid Colby Clemens was the catcher for that, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think
they had some sort of deal like that. You know, yeah, I think, you know, that's one of the things that made me, you know, we talk about Ricky Henderson. If you didn't like Ricky Henderson before, it's impossible not to love a guy
right.
who was going to play baseball as long as he could possibly let him do it. Yeah. You know, he was going to stick around and play as long as he could. But, you know, that's the beauty of some of this kind of stuff.
All right, well, I'm still holding out hope that Julio Franco's got one more. The Cardinals need a right-handed bat off the bench, man. So I'm no offense to Joey Butler, but I could use one more. I feel like he's got a couple of line drives left in him. But the problem is if he has a good run in August somewhere, the Mets will sign him for 3 years again, and that won't we won't want that to happen. Ryan, thank you for your time. This was really fun. Thank you for scratching my baseball itch today. I would love to have you on again, and keep up the great work, man.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot, Will.
Be safe. All right, thank you to Ryan Fagan. Sorry, we had some audio issues. We had some cell phone static with him at the end of that call. But yeah, you should have heard it the first call time we tried it. It was really bad then. But it's Sunday night, and I need a Monday show. So he did great, and he was great. We lost him a little at the end, but I hope you hung in, because Ryan's a really smart guy, and he had a lot of good stuff to say. So anyway, thank you to Ryan Fagan. You can follow him on Twitter, at Ryan Fagan, RyanFagan. This has been the Will H. Experience Podcast. The music is by the Sundogs. Please rate and review us on iTunes. Tuesday's guest is Dave Zirin. He's a sports reporter for The Nation, former guest of the Will H. Experience Podcast, and author of the new book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, about his trip to Brazil as we approach the World Cup. And by the way, we're going to be doing a full week of World Cup shows. So if you don't care about the World Cup, you're going to get a week off. Because it's not this week, by the way. We're doing regular shows this week. But in a couple weeks, you know, we're like 3 weeks away from the World Cup now. So, you know, there's going to be a week if you really don't care about the World Cup. And you should, by the way. But if you really don't care about the World Cup, you're going to get a week off of the podcast soon. Though I guess you could just take off a week anytime you wanted to anyway. Because, you know, who cares? It's not like a subscription where you're wasting money. Anyway, all right, I'll talk to you and Dave tomorrow.